Most of the creatures we share the planet with have stories to tell, but you have to know how to listen. Morning Edition is going to explain how with our project on close listening, decoding nature through sound. NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce and audio producer Bill McCoy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology start us out today with a look at how scientists started learning to listen.
The natural world is noisy, with howler monkeys, whales in the ocean deep, or insects in a backyard tree. Bill McCoy and I recorded a lot of the natural world for an NPR program called Radio Expeditions.
That audio is archived at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, where I work now, in a room stacked with shelves of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes.
It's the world's largest collection of natural sounds. And Bill and I got to wondering, who captured all that sound and what did they learn from it? So I went to see the collection.
Collection storage, room 132. Let's go exploring.
Yeah.
What do you call these things?
Well, space saver movable shelves.
Do you have any idea how many recordings are here?
Hundreds of thousands.
There's a lot here. Elephant seals. I remember that. This was elephant seals on the coast of California, where they pull up onto the beach and basically lie around and make a lot of noise.
The sounds that every 10-year-old would love to make.
What else do we have? How about the elephant bai in the Central African Republic? There
it is. That would be up here.
And that's when you were on.
That's right. The sound was the best way to develop a census of how many elephants were in the area, because forest elephants, as large as the elephant may be, once it's in the rainforest, you don't see them.
Yeah, you can't see them.
We realized that this sound tells a story about how science learned to listen. Seeing used to be everything. Microscopes illuminated the invisibly tiny. Telescopes revealed the heavens. But sound, not important. Until an amazing invention came along.
The first time that one could see this kind of listening culture developing is with the development of the stethoscope, so the beginning of the 19th century in Paris.
Professor Trevor Pinch teaches the history of science and technology at Cornell University. He reminds us that you couldn't see inside a body back then.
Unless it was dead.
Yeah, but that was too late. A stethoscope told a living story of circulating blood or the seesawing of lungs.
It was one of the first ways of actually getting a diagnosis on a patient independent of their own version of what was happening. In fact, it's become so important, it's kind of the emblem of the physician is often the stethoscope around the neck. That's how you tell who the doc is.
I found one of those doctors in Ithaca, New York. He was teaching a medical student how to use a stethoscope to diagnose a heart problem in one of his patients.
We joined them in the doctor's examining room.
I'm Adam Law. I'm a physician. I'm both a primary care physician and an endocrinologist.
I'm Nick Mastin. I'm a third-year medical student.
Okay, so why don't we bring you into the examination? Nick, why don't you examine this patient's cardiovascular system?
All right.
Nick has an electronic stethoscope that I plug into my recorder.
So that we can listen too, but they've warned us, interpreting sounds from inside the body is not for amateurs.
As a student, it's hard to learn. It takes listening to hundreds, thousands of hearts before you start to figure that out.
Nick places the bell of the instrument on the patient's neck, right on the carotid artery.
We could hear the sound of the heart pumping blood through its aortic valve and out into the pulsing carotid artery.
So this is the second position here.
Nick moves the bell to the patient's side, placing it just under the armpit.
Hear the difference in quality?
Yeah.
Thank you. Hear a very loud second heart sound.
The patient has a heart murmur, a malfunction of the heart valves that control blood flow. Textbooks say you can hear a murmur's swishing sound.
But I sure couldn't hear any swishing sound.
Yeah, neither could I, but Nick apparently did.
So do you want me to talk about what I heard?
Yes, what did you hear?
It sounded like a mitral murmur, but I heard it best where I would expect to hear an aortic murmur. So this is a situation where Dr. Law is going to have to jump in and rescue me.
He has a little bit of both. We've learned that you can sometimes have two different murmurs in the same heart.
Dr. Law said Bill and I simply didn't know what to listen for.
The musical note of the heart is actually complicated. It has harmonics and it has overtones, and that gives the sounds and the murmurs that you hear within the heart a certain quality. And one has to tune in one's ears.
So how do you tune your ears? We asked Trevor Pinch, the history professor.
But so pattern recognition is the key.
Yes, that pattern is easy.
But many are not. Take birdsong. This is a recording of two mustache wrens. The singing appears random until the birds synchronize and a pattern emerges.
Patterns tell us things, like how birds collaborate.
Then there's the fact that sound is everywhere.
The visual field's kind of in front of us. It's like a kind of screen. And sound is all around.
Seeing is an art gallery. Hearing is a swimming pool.
And we're swimming all the time. At night, we'll wake up to a baby's cry or to the sound of danger.
And it's probably been evolutionary very, very important how we become attuned to sound at night.
So, okay, interpreting sound has survival value, but to really study it, well, that was a problem.
In one ear and out the other.
Ephemeral.
Until another revolutionary invention.
I think that the development of the phonograph in particular around 1880, that really does change how we think about sound, because for the first time ever, sound is really transportable. You can store it in a medium.
When people could capture sound and really listen.
That opened up a whole new world. That's our next story. I'm Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And I'm Bill McQuay.